ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So amongst many nightmares of having young kids...
It's actually quite pleasant.
I suspect the worst one you've got is when you get a phone call from the kindy.
Can I say that I've got two kids at school now?
So you don't get the phone call to come and pick them up?
We must touch wood because it could happen as we are talking. But it is a parent's or caregiver's nightmare because it happens often. There are lots of viral infections floating around, and the chaos is who leaves work, what do you do, and how many days off are you going to need?
And are the kindies overreacting for the slight sniffle to take your child home? And of course, when the parents come and see you, the GP, they say, look, my child's had almost constant infections in the last year. And no doubt what you say is...
No doubt. Well, it's actually quite complex, Norman, because 6 to 12 viral infections a year is considered normal for preschool aged children. And what I say to parents is it feels like one big illness, but if you really nut out the history, it's often that they get one virus, they're just getting better, then they get another one, and it feels relentless, and it is.
But there's a but, and that's coming up on this week's Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
Also on the show, the rising cost of paying for a non-GP specialist, a new report finds that some people are delaying or cancelling appointments, others are fundraising to cover their cancer treatment.
Having to stump up $5,000 before I can even get on the list, it's not until you think about it later that you think, gee whiz, I've paid for more than one BMW repayment for him.
And you'll hear more of people's personal stories, plus an analysis of the situation very shortly. Because what can be done to drive down costs? And does the answer lie in the private or public system, for example?
In the news, Norman, a lot of people will have seen Nipah virus mentioned, and perhaps people are panicking or pondering, is this the next pandemic?
And I gauge this by, you know, how many phone calls I get on the floor at Radio National. Should we be doing a story on this? Or should we be panicking about it and so on? So here's a bit of background. There were two cases reported in West Bengal. First one was a female nurse and the other one was a male nurse. So Nipah virus is of the same family of viruses as Hendra virus. Its natural habitat or its reservoir comes from animals or fruit bats, flying foxes. And the process seems to be, so people might remember the Hendra virus. You remember the Hendra virus story,
which
went from bats to horses to Vic Rail, the horse trainer who died. I mean, Nipah virus has a case fatality rate of at least 40%. Sometimes people would argue up to 75% in some outbreaks. The first outbreak was 1998 in Malaysian pig farmers, and it spread to Singapore.
And over 100 people died in that outbreak. In Malaysia.
Yeah. And often with the first outbreak, it can be much worse than subsequent outbreaks, partly because we've learned how to control it and look for it. But almost certainly what happened there was the bat spread it to the pigs and the pigs spread it to humans. And then there was some human-to-human transmission. And many people can just be a flu-like illness with a sore throat. But then it can become a serious pneumonia. And then it can become an encephalitis, which can be fatal. So it's a potentially nasty disease. There is what gets me about this is there's an animal vaccine for Hendra, but not for humans. And there's nothing for Nipah virus.
Nipah. Not yet, although I believe the University of Oxford is working on something, aren't they?
Well, the University of Oxford, which is where the AstraZeneca vaccine came from for COVID-19, are very good on these new and emerging viruses.
I think, Norman, when there's something new, particularly a virus, people get quite nervous. I've had some patients ask me what I think about what's happening in that. As I said, why hasn't it been on the health report yet? But the World Health Organization, or the WHO at the moment, have said the global risk is low. and there's no confirmed spread out of India. So it's really important to note the two cases you've mentioned, the nearly 200 contacts they've tested, it hasn't spread. The bats that tend to host the Nipah virus do actually exist in Australia and throughout Asia and the South Pacific. So at the moment, there's no evidence of Nipah virus in Australia or any human cases, but I guess the flying foxes are around.
And as we live closer and closer to the bush, other animals, as we go to intensive agriculture to feed the world, this is when the spread of these viruses, including coronaviruses and influenza, become much riskier.
Closer to home and in other news, in the state of Victoria, the state government has just announced that they're going to change the way that patients with an existing diagnosis and prescription for ADHD medications can actually attain repeat scripts. And
for you can just make a telephone call.
You can now access scripts if you need it in a situation where you can't see your regular prescriber, psychiatrist or GP. You can hop on to the virtual ED, which is essentially where you have a consult through telehealth, through a Zoom call with an ED clinician. And you can get a repeat script for your ADHD medication, and it might be up to 6 months' supply.
What's the panic over ADHD? I don't understand. It seems to be that everybody is really worried about it.
The reason I, as a GP, shudder at this announcement is I have a lot of patients, Norman, with the diagnosis of ADHD. It's been done by a psychiatrist who dispenses the prescribing rights to me. They write me a formal letter. They give me advice on all the testing that needs to be done prior, including things like an ECG, so looking at a tracing of the heart, a urine drug screen so we know what they say they're taking is what they're taking. We have to do blood pressure, a whole heap of bloods. And I have to apply for a permit to prescribe this medication. When I do that prescription, I actually don't often give a patient 6 months' supply. Particularly in the start, when we're trying to get the dose correct, people can have side effects, sleep issues, appetite suppression. They might have high blood pressure. They might have worsening of other mood disorders, suicidal ideation. So when the Victorian government says we are going to allow people to hop onto this virtual ED with a clinician they don't know who might give them a huge quantity of this medication, which can cause harm, that is frightening. And we've talked on the show last week about disconnect with telehealth services and the regular prescriber, the GP or psychiatrist, not being aware the patient has a huge quantity of the med. I think it could be really, really harmful.
We'll keep an eye on this, and we're not the only ones saying it. The College of General Practitioners, the College of Psychiatrists are saying this as well, and it's not just defending turf. It is, as you say, about safety.
It is.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. Well, on Thursday, Private Healthcare Australia, which is the umbrella association covering the private health insurance industry, released two studies, which are really part of the same study, on the rise and economic impact of out-of-pocket costs and medical fees, and also the impact on individuals of this rise in medical costs. Quite dramatic. And we'll come to the details in a moment, Priya, of what these reports showed. But the quick takeaway is out-of-pocket medical costs keep on rising and are quite significant, and some people are dipping into their superannuation to pay for them.
And we did speak to a range of people about their experiences with out-of-pocket costs in the private system, and here's a glimpse of what they had to say.
It was a real shock, as well as having the existential threat of a breast cancer diagnosis. I was then faced with trying to understand and navigate healthcare costs, what the difference was between private and public, what was rebatable, what wasn't, what private healthcare covered and what it didn't cover.
I was in with a radiation oncologist within days. They really talk it through with you about how much it genuinely costs. Roughly, I would have paid upfront $17,000 to $20,000. You then get the Medicare rebate back on all of that. So you end up being roughly $5,000 out of pocket, but you still have to have $20,000 there ready to be paid.
And all these costs, I totally was not aware going down that path of using your private health fund that the specialist costs would be really significant. So I wiped out all my savings, and it wasn't easy to then ask my father to help me with that.
for every $50, $100, $200, $400, $75, whatever it might be, slowly adds up. The Medicare system is magnificent. You still have to outlay that money anyway, and you get a pittance back.
Yeah, so that was our house savings. Wasn't expecting to end up with cancer. I was also extraordinarily fortunate that my sister-in-law, whilst I was in hospital, went and organised a GoFundMe, and that raised roughly $25,000, which significantly helped us through the entire ordeal.
Wow, we're talking big numbers.
Yeah, it's one of the big dilemmas. I mean, a few years ago, I did a Four Corners on this called Mind the Gap, if you want to look for it. And we did a call out for people to tell us their stories. And the stories were very similar to those. And what's depressing is you've gone and made a Four Corners on this and nothing changes. In fact, it's got worse. People are suffering. People are going into their super. And in fact, going into your super probably inflates the market, because if doctors think that they can just tell you to go and get into your super, that means they can charge even more. And so our behaviour can make things worse. So I spoke to one of the authors of the study, who's an economist, Dr. Adam Triggs of Mandala Consulting, about what their research found.
The research was inspired by the cost of living crisis in Australia. And so we've been looking at what are the big structural drivers of inflation. And over the last 10 years, if you exclude things like alcohol and tobacco, which are driven by taxation, the number one driver has been healthcare costs.
I mean, that's a surprise. I mean, that's what you'd expect to hear if you're in the United States of America, but it's true of Australia as well.
It is. It's surprising, and it does sound a bit like what you would hear in America. We're seeing more people who are now traveling for medical tourism because we have out-of-pocket costs so high in some jurisdictions, like my hometown of Canberra, compared to others like Adelaide. And so we're seeing things that are much more common in America, which is people traveling for medical costs.
I did a Four Corners on this several years ago, and it doesn't sound as if much has changed. Has it got worse?
Yeah, it has. When we look across time, we can see that there is this persistent increase in inflation coming out of the healthcare sector, and we can see out-of-pocket costs continuing to rise. So at the moment, we're seeing Australian households spending about $1.3 billion every year on out-of-pocket costs, and that's been increasing steadily. And if it keeps going, it'll hit $1.7 billion by 2030.
So let's take a dive as to where the costs are and the dimensions of the out-of-pocket.
We certainly see a big difference across jurisdictions. So the average out-of-pocket costs for one procedure in Canberra is about $605. In Adelaide, it's about $228.
Which procedure is that?
This is the average across, looking across a whole range of procedures. But if you were to take just one example and you were to think of, say, a hip replacement, we see that before people go into hospital, they're looking at up to $200 just for initial consultations. Once they're in hospital, they're looking at about $1,600 for the actual replacement.
This is out of pocket.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then you've got accommodation fees of about $300, the anaesthetist of $300, and then another $200 when you're out of hospital. The difference between procedures is really stark as well. And we've heard stories where people are paying $20,000, $30,000 in out-of-pocket costs for breast cancer treatment, for example.
What about non-procedural medicine? Because you can be significantly out-of-pocket with that too.
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing it fairly systemically across the entire journey as we map out what this looks like for different people getting different treatments. And we've done some surveys as well of a variety of people to ask them what's really driving this. And one of the core challenges they have is really just being able to compare prices across different specialists and different services.
But aren't doctors supposed to have financial consent?
Yeah. I mean, when we talk to consumers, about one in two consumers were not aware of fees prior to their appointment with specialists. We found a lot of them were under significant financial stress. We found that about 50% of them received unexpected bills for medical services. About 29% were charged administrative or booking fees, which
are illegal.
Absolutely. And so there's definitely an issue here around both just enforcing existing laws, but also having things like the Medical Cost Finder website and improving that as much as we can to try and improve this transparency so people can make better decisions.
Well, you're an economist. The argument for these transparent sites is that it actually causes inflation of medical fees in the same way as you can trace back CEO salaries going up in the general economy, having to declare CEO salaries. And one CEO sees another CEO getting $2 million and they're getting $1 million. They'll say, well, why are they getting $2 million? I'm going to charge $2 million. And when a surgeon or a physician sees a fee that is higher than theirs for the same one, they say, well, why shouldn't I be charging that? So isn't transparency in that public sense inflationary itself?
There's definitely research around CEO salaries, and I think that's an example of where it backfired. And really, that was driven by businesses making sure they wanted to be seen that they had high-paid CEOs. I don't think it really translates to this story here. I mean, what we teach our students in Econ 101 is that markets don't function without transparency.
But markets don't function in healthcare. Healthcare's market failure, as is education. So, I mean, can you even think about applying market forces to medicine?
I think you can. I mean, we have a hybrid system in Australia, which that's a combination of Medicare and a government-provided system and a private system. In both instances, but particularly the private system, we do need to make sure that we get these markets functioning well. And part of this is a supply-side issue. There's obviously big challenges in getting more specialists in, and there's a variety of things that address that. But really, a big part of this is for any market to function properly, you need to have transparency. Buyers need to be able to see all the options and all the prices and to be able to make decisions based on that.
What about price control? Successive governments have been terrified by a decision by the High Court in 1948 in relation to the pharmaceutical benefits scheme. And they've assumed that that means that you cannot coerce doctors to do anything at all. Is it time to challenge that and put in cost control?
Well, I think there's a lot of things you can look at. You can look at price controls. There are things on the supply side in terms of all of the constraints that are slowing us down and getting more specialists in. I think the lens here is to think about what's the lowest hanging fruit. And in my mind, it's going to be things like transparency, and it's going to be things like enforcing existing laws around misleading and deceptive conduct and making sure that we're getting those basics right.
How do you explain the differences between cities?
We don't see the number of specialists alone being the core driver, which tells you that there might be more of sort of cultural issues at play here and other factors that are driving some of these differences. They're just too stark to be explained by just looking at the number of specialists.
When you challenge specialists about this, they say, well, if the government were to increase the Medicare rebates, we'd be much happier. But what I remember a few years ago, they did that with obstetrics. And all that did was increase the cost in obstetrics. I think it was under Tony Abbott. There was a rebate when you got to a certain amount. And all that happened is that the obstetricians just charged up to that amount and increased their income. Where do Medicare rebates sit within this? Because, I mean, we have to say this research is sponsored by Private Healthcare Australia, which is the overarching organisation for the private health insurance industry. And they would say their rebates are tied to the Medicare rebates.
Yeah, that's correct. And really what we've got here is more of a structural challenge around, and we can see this over time, that this isn't a new thing. This has been something that's been building up and is continuing to build. And so the concern with the rebate and increasing that is that not only you potentially just see that getting absorbed into prices, but it ends up adding more into the inflationary pressure here as well.
Have you looked at the income levels of the specialists? So, for example, anecdotally, I hear in orthopaedic surgery, you've got young orthopaedic surgeons coming in, and the business isn't there in the same way as it used to be. Is that expectation of salary or income, how does that play into this?
Again, if you go back to thinking about this as a market and you think about, well, how competitive is the market and what are people's ability to increase prices? Whatever your expectations are, if you have a transparent market where people can shop around, if you've got strong competition and you've got lots of different options, well, then those sort of expectations shouldn't really be able to flow through the system anyway.
So when you've done this research, you've also looked, apart from the economic side, you've looked at the impact of consumers. What are the key findings there?
What we found is about 1.2 million consumers will delay or avoid accessing specialist care by 2030. So this is an additional 330,000 people who are delaying accessing care from 2024. We know that young people in particular are more likely to do this. So another 10,000 young people will be avoiding specialist care because of rising costs by 2030. We can see this in other areas as well. So we know in superannuation, for example, there was more than $1 billion withdrawn in 2024. which if you track that through means that by the time someone retires, they've lost about $48,000 in their super account. So there's a really big concern here around a false economy, that we're seeing these short-term impacts, which are going to have these very big long-term consequences.
Can you give us your top two or three policy recommendations here for government?
I think transparency is the main recommendation here. We've got the Medical Cost Finder website, which is an opportunity for consumers to get on there and to look at what are the different options available to them and to be able to shop around. But we do have a bunch of problems with that that can be improved. So one option is to have an opt-out system for specialists, and that would boost the amount of data that's in the system. We can add patient reviews and quality metrics to the system. We can support GPs with a referral tool to show specialists in their local area by price to patients so that they can make more informed decisions as well. There are other things we can do to increase the supply of specialists that are both being trained and able to come into the country. But I think in terms of the fastest things that we can do and those lowest hanging fruit, we'll be looking at transparency in particular.
Dr. Adam Triggs of Mandela Consulting.
I find this extremely interesting. I think as both a doctor, and I have to declare that my husband is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon as well, so we have these kinds of discussions at home all the time. I do think, Norman, that the reasons for the rising out-of-pocket costs are really multifactorial and really quite complex. And I often refer patients to the private sector because the public system is completely overwhelmed. They're often going to wait 18 months for an appointment. And so I give patients the option, and some people will go, you know what, for my cervical cancer screening test finding, I need a colposcopy. I'd rather get that done soon. I'll go and see someone privately and accept the cost. So I think some of it is that the public system is extremely overwhelmed, and we actually have to work on improving access there, which I know is, you know, a lot of think tanks and people are working on that. But I also don't think it is necessarily, I think there are some practitioners who definitely either surgical or physician. I think some of them are perhaps, you know, it is a greed issue. We have to acknowledge that.
Well, it's hard to justify a $20,000 to $30,000 out of pocket for a prostatectomy.
I agree.
Which in Melbourne, you could be $500 to $1,000 out of pocket, depending whether you live in Canberra, Sydney or Melbourne. I mean, you cannot blame, for example, your Medicare rebate being low when you're charging thousands, and some are.
When it's that huge discrepancy, I 100% agree with you. I think for some specialties, like I know a lot of neurologists who will spend an hour with the patient doing a full assessment examination, and it's a complex consult, it needs an hour, and the rebate doesn't necessarily reflect that complexity. And so I explain to patients, you know, this is why the cost is, this is what to expect.
And another example is pediatricians who are developmental pediatricians who do, say, an assessment of a child for autism spectrum disorder. You've got to do extra training to do the assessment. Then you've got to do the assessment, which takes a long time. And as with ADHD, you've got to assess teachers and other people around the child. Then you've got to write the report. Mm. It could be 3 hours' work, for which
the rebate just doesn't do it.
No. And what's the rebate? $180 or something,
yeah,
like that?
So I think we really need to openly admit that this is complex. I'm not sure that I agree with Adam that the Cost Finder website is necessarily going to improve things and help with, you know, maybe some transparency, but will it fix the issue? And one patient who spoke to us, Greg, had some comments on that as well.
If fees could be signposted, more accessible, that'd be a great idea. But whether that actually makes the situation better, I doubt it. What needs to happen is for the Medicare benchmark payments have not kept up with the actual health issues and costs.
The other issue here is, where I disagree with Adam, is he seemed to believe, maybe it coincides with what you're thinking, Priya, is that medicine operates like a market, and it doesn't.
Mm, it doesn't.
It is not. There's market failure. And the reason there's market failure, and it just comes to its transparency, is there's what's called in economic terms information asymmetry. The reason that we have rules about advertising and truth in advertising is that you want to know when they say something about the fridge you're about to buy, that it's true. And you can compare one car to another. It's hard. It's very hard. But at least there's more information about cars than your medical care. So I, as a doctor, know a lot more than you. And if I say to you, I need to see you three times over the next 3 weeks, or you need this operation, who are they to say no? And what doctors are able to do is generate income. So this is what's happening. Let's take orthopedics, for example.
Okay.
There's less knee surgery to be done, but you want to maintain your income. So what some orthopedic surgeons are doing is they're splitting down platelets and giving you a platelet injection. What other orthopedic surgeons are doing is that they're finding something wrong with your hip.
Or charging you more for the actual procedure to make it up. But can I say about this CostFinder website? What happens, Norman, when you log on and go, oh, well, my gap fee for a carpal tunnel and I'm a subspecialised hand surgeon is a couple of hundred. This person's quoting $10,000.
And people will think the quality is higher because it's $10,000 and there is no relationship between quality and the fee charged.
And they do, Norman. I've had patients say to me, but Priya, isn't that too cheap? I really want the best person here. The cost doesn't necessarily reflect someone's knowledge. And often the people who are really, really good at their job aren't charging these exorbitant amounts. I think as a GP, I'll quite enjoy the site for being able to compare and actually talk to patients when I'm referring, because it's really hard, Norman, to know what people are charging.
And you know, there is the issue of bill shock. And what Adam was talking about there, which was booking fees, is that you turn up and these could be surgeons or procedural specialists who've done a deal with the health insurer that they will charge no gap or known gap. And then you find them charging a booking fee. And that is actually, some people would argue, illegal.
You know, and talking about this bill shock, we had someone speak to us, Luan Lawrence-Woods, who in 2020 had a breast reconstruction combined with gynecological surgery. And she got quotes from both surgeons and it was eye-opening.
On the day of my surgery, which was 8 months after the quote, in the pre-op room, I was introduced to the gynae surgeon's assisting surgeon, who I didn't even know would be there. And I was like, oh, hello. So that's the first time that I met that assisting surgeon. That's the first time that I heard that I would be needing one. And at that point, you know, you're really nervous. You're in the pre-op room and you're meeting somebody that you're thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm probably going to get a bill for that later. But I didn't know about that. And I did. I was out of pocket $570 for something that I wasn't expecting and I hadn't been told about.
Women's health advocate Luan Lawrence-Woods. Hayley also experienced substantial costs in relation to breast cancer treatment, but it was complicated for her because she was living regionally.
It was only because I had access to accommodation that I could travel up to Brisbane and stay up there for treatment. I live regionally. I am a single parent, but I've chosen to go down the having private health cover. You forego other things in your life to afford those expenses, but the shock of the gap that you pay is quite shocking.
So given everything that we're hearing, Norman, we decided to speak to someone who is a physician who could perhaps provide us with some more insight. That person was Professor Jennifer Martin, who's a clinical pharmacologist and the president of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians.
Well, I think it's complex. I think I just wanted to start by saying that the RACP, our college, does not set or recommend fees and does not support exorbitant or unreasonable fees. The complication we have is that a lot of patients now have a lot of chronic issues. So you might go to a gastroenterologist because you think you might like a scope. And when you get to the gastroenterologist realises that actually you've got a whole lot of other medical issues, including sometimes mental health issues that need to be sorted out. So whilst you can bill for the consultation, the Medicare rebate for a complex consultation as our population ages and has more chronic medical issues hasn't kept pace.
I agree with that, Jenny, but it's certainly not, I think, the whole picture, because there is a real discrepancy, isn't there, in what people can actually charge. Someone might charge $400 and someone else might charge $800 or $1,000. Do you think that transparency and the CostFinder website is going to help?
Yes, and the College of Physicians certainly supports financial transparency. I think it's really important to note, though, that the setting of fees is complex. Fees should definitely align with community and professional standards of fairness and reasonableness. I think it'd be interesting to actually have a look at the fees that oncologists are charging in a regional centre or rural centre as opposed to a metro centre. And I think that's contributed to by the different costs that professionals in different jurisdictions might encounter.
I mean, there are two or three issues here. One is people think if they're paying a lot of money, they're getting better quality, and that's absolutely not true.
Correct.
And secondly, we've got no idea. I often say we focus on surgeons for this sort of thing, you know, how much you're spending for. Because it's easy to measure quality in surgery. Do you get an infection? Do you die in 30 days? Adam's talking about transparency. And one of the things about transparency is quality. And we've got no idea whether one oncologist is better than another, whether one endocrinologist is better than another. there's no monitoring. And that is your area. That is the area of the College of Physicians, is about quality and standards.
Correct. That is our remit. You're correct in the sense that when we have fellowed our physicians, that we are comfortable that they are all practicing at that high standard. What subsequently happens with people in the public system is that we can actually see each other and what they're doing. I think in the private system, that might be more difficult to oversee.
I do think, though, a lot of this falls to, as a referrer, as a GP, I think it falls to people like us doing a lot of work in the consulting room. And I do think transparency there in terms of fees and perhaps quality, what you're talking about, Norman, might be quite useful. And patient reviews, which Adam mentioned as well. I just wonder, Jenny, do you think that strengthening the public system is part of the solution here? Because I know a lot of people turn to private because the public waiting list, particularly for non-procedural things, so seeing an endocrinologist or a neurologist, are so long. The public system is so burdened. Is that part of the problem, and what's the solution there?
Yes, I think that that's a really good point, because I think we're really focusing on fees, and fees alone won't fix the affordability or the access issue, or indeed the issue that you've raised, Norman, which is around quality. And how do you know that somebody, once they're off practicing in private, is actually meeting standards? So the public health system is an issue. And I note the recent injection of funds from the Albanese government. However, that's really got to address the workplace shortages.
One of the solutions put forward in this report is increasing supply, particularly in rural areas. There's been controversy with the College of Surgeons over many years that they just don't have enough training positions in rural areas. And what's known is that if you train in a rural area, you're much more likely to stay in a rural area. And also relaxing the rules to some extent on people coming in with specialist qualifications, non-GP specialist qualifications from overseas. What's the College of Physicians' position on both?
If I can focus on the first question, which is support in the regional, rural and remote areas, our college has put a significant amount of work into this and working with state and Commonwealth governments on how we actually attract people to train there and what the college can do to actually support people training in the regional areas. If we train people in the regions, they tend to stay there. So previously, we couldn't do that within our college because people had to go into the metro sites to be signed off by a senior physician. We've just actually approved and we've launched actually our first lot of physician trainees who can do all of their training in a regional area in WA. In terms of supporting people from overseas to come and work in Australia, we've always had a very strong overseas training program for overseas physicians. And we did support also the discussions around supporting overseas people to come and to go out to regional sites, noting that for a lot of practitioners that come in from overseas and go into regional sites, it's quite daunting for them. And often they leave those regional sites within a short period of time because they don't feel well acculturated and supported in those sites. So we were quite dismayed, I think, to see that the government was then not requiring them to be part of the college and not requiring them to be acculturated into the Australian system and actually enabling them to set up straight away within the metro sites. So not only are these people not supported in a network of specialists, but they're actually not required to go to the regional setting. So so we're not really sure what benefit this is providing, A, to their practitioners, or B, to the needs that we have in the regional and remote workplaces. And we're also concerned because the whole acculturation issue is not covered because these people don't have the supervision and they don't have the oversight of standards that they have in our current OTP pathway.
That was Professor Jennifer Martin, who's the president of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians.
And we'd welcome your comments. Just email us at healthreport@abc.net.au. We have had a response from the Medical Oncology Group of Australia, who represent medical oncologists. These are the non-procedural people who look after you when you've got cancer. And we'll have that response on our website.
I think we couldn't have this discussion, Norman, without at least touching on psychiatry, but it is bound by a different college, so different to physicians and surgeons. I think a lot of people are shocked that they might be paying for private health insurance, but when they go and see a psychiatrist for either a mood disorder, ADHD assessment, an eating disorder, the private health doesn't necessarily cover the out-of-pocket costs for the consult, for the outpatient consult. And I have seen a real spectrum of what people are charged. It could be $800. It could be $2,500.
$2,500?
And for a lot of patients, Norman, going through the public system when it comes to psychiatry is...
Oh, it's a disaster.
...really difficult. That's why a lot of people go privately and then there are huge out-of-pocket costs. So, look, I think we have tried to cover this as best we can, acknowledging that it's a very complex issue, and hopefully we've done it justice.
And you're with the health report, which probably only costs you a few cents off your taxation on ABC Radio National. And I thought this week, because some parents are sending their children, their toddlers, to daycare for the first time, and they're embarking on a journey, and the journey is often one of infectious diseases, upper respiratory infections. And this is the joy you're about to behold. And I wanted to go back to a paper, a really important paper that came out actually a year ago, which showed that, in fact, what you're told by your GP is not necessarily, or your paediatrician, is not necessarily right when you say, oh, they seem to be having almost constant infections. Is that a problem? They say, no. That's what happens. It's your immune system being trained. But in fact, there is a threshold beyond which there might be increasing risk as the child gets older. And this is a study which followed children from their early years through to about the age of 10 or 13. But anyway, somebody who's going to explain the study and its implications is Dr. Lini Fong, who is a paediatric infectious disease specialist in Melbourne.
What this study found is that children who had more infections in the first 3 years of life were more likely to have more moderate to severe infections and be exposed perhaps to more systemic antibiotic courses later in their childhood. And this was corrected for things like social and environmental factors, so daycare exposure, siblings, smoking, and other socioeconomic factors.
So they were just trying to isolate the influence of how many multiples of infection you had. And where was the cutoff in terms of where it started to increase the risk of needing antibiotics, you know, during the school years, maybe having an episode of pneumonia or something more serious than that?
What they found was that those who had a high infection burden, and high, they said, more than 16 episodes.
Like 16 episodes a year.
Per year, correct. Were more likely to have double the risk of moderate to severe infections later on. I guess what that means is that children who were sick as toddlers were more likely to have more serious infections later in childhood. The other finding around antibiotics was that they found that those who had, you know, those high infections in early childhood were about 30% more likely to need antibiotics as they grew older. So coming back to your question around, you know, how we talk to parents, you know, as you said, we say that it's normal to get lots of infections in daycare, and it's normal to, you know, obviously help them train their immune systems. But perhaps there are a cohort of kids that we need to keep a closer eye on as they grow up, because perhaps they have an underlying susceptibility and it's not just a phase that they're going through.
I mean, how would you know as a parent? I mean, for example, 16 infections a year, it's one every few weeks. I mean, it's almost as if your child is constantly sick. To have more than that, it's hard for parents to notice the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And parents know their children's best and they understand when their kid is not quite right. I think it's really important for all families to have a really good GP that they're able to check in with, because I guess what this study shows is that if these children, if there is a cohort of children who are more likely to get ongoing infections, you want to make sure that when they have antibiotics that they actually need them.
So what do we know about the Australian situation? I mean, that's Denmark.
Yes. So in Australia, what the ASCIA guidelines talk about is that...
So this is the Australian Society of Clinical Immunology and Allergy.
Correct. And they talk about normal healthy toddlers experiencing up to 4 to 8 minor infections per year. But they do say that you can expect up to 12 infections per year if a child attends childcare or if they have older siblings or parents who smoke.
But they're not saying that 12 is the threshold for worry later on in life. The Denny study would suggest it's much higher than that.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it's certainly in my practice, what I see is a lot of worried parents about children who have constant infections. And obviously, we do look at other factors. You know, we think about whether or not they are gaining weight appropriately, whether or not there's a family history of immune deficiencies, because that is definitely a question that comes up. And I think this particular study considers whether or not these children are susceptible to something else, whether they've got that underlying anatomical or immunological or asthma or maybe microbiome reasons. Maybe that this study shows that there is a signal in children early on that needs to be monitored with a healthcare professional.
And the main thing you could do presumably is immunisation so that they don't get unnecessary infections.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what about prevention at a daycare centre level? I mean, it drives parents nuts. The slightest sniffle, you get a phone call at work and you've got to come and pick up the child. Is there more that daycare centres could be doing?
I mean, this is such a challenge because...
Once they've got a sniffle, they've already spread the cold. That's the irony.
That's right, exactly. And, you know, a lot of infections just start off with a little bit of a runny nose. Yes, there are exclusion policies and recommendations around making sure that children don't attend when they have sniffly noses or coughs, definitely when they have a fever or if they have gastro symptoms. But I understand that that would be so difficult to police. And, you know, as a parent of a young child myself, I know how hard it can be to stay away when there's any sort of sniffle or cough. So I think it's a really difficult scenario, to be honest.
That was Dr. Lindy Fong, who's a paediatric infectious disease specialist based in Melbourne. And we have a link to that paper on our website.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. We've had Maria write in relation to a piece that we did on breast density reporting that's happening in Australia and the potential psychological stress that it causes women. Maria's written in and says, thanks for the piece on dense breasts. I wonder if you could do a follow-up. I'm 64 and I've been diagnosed with dense breasts, so BI-RADS C. And the follow-up with my GP
pointed... Is that just the rating of how dense the breasts are?
C and D are...
Which is quite unusual. When you get older, they're supposed to become less dense.
Yes, with estrogen changes. And follow-up with my GP pointed to an enhanced contrast mammogram. Could you discuss any alternatives, ultrasound scans? I have a history of breast cancer with my mum diagnosed at 72 years old, of family history. So I'm trying to stay on top of this. And I think, oh, and says many thanks and love the show. We shouldn't leave out the positive thing for us, don't you think?
No, that's
no.
Right.
I think this is what the point of the whole discussion was, Norman, is that there is no clear answer in terms of what do you do if you've got dense breasts on screening, and it might be that you need this enhanced contrast mammogram, or maybe you need an ultrasound, or maybe you need a breast specialist opinion. And therein lies all the nuance and the complexity and the potential uncertainty.
And I think that we can't give individual advice here, but it may be that you discuss with your GP a referral to a breast expert and for a proper assessment of this.
Carol has also written in and says, your episode on breast screening was very relevant as I just had my 2-year screen. I've been screening since my 30s as two of my mum's cousins and her grandmother died of breast cancer. My former GP of about 20 years always referred me for an ultrasound as she said my breasts are dense and she would rather be sure. I got my mammogram results and it said no dense breasts. But when I went to my GP and asked for the ultrasound anyway, he said in his report it said there were areas of dense breasts that could obstruct view. I was not told that. So the GP has written me a referral for an ultrasound. It's on Medicare and it's free.
Just shows you've got to be able to advocate for yourself and not take a step back.
But I should also add that not all scans are free, Norman. Often patients will have an out-of-pocket cost. We've just done a whole episode on that. But it's not common that you will have your radiology bulk billed necessarily. And it can occur at some centres or if I, as the GP, write on there, please bulk bill the patient. But it's not necessarily normal for the subsequent follow-up tests to be Medicare funded. I think we need to set expectations very clearly there that there could be an out-of-pocket cost.
Keep your questions and comments coming in. And the email address is...
healthreport@abc.net.au.
And don't forget our sister podcast, What's That Rash? This week we're answering the question, are fish oil supplements worth taking?
Do you take them?
No.
Oh, me neither. I'll see you next week then.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.